our shoulders hunched for as long as we could, adding to our mantra. It's raining now, and we have nowhere to go. What are we going to do? A couple of the men were able to wrench open a car door, and a few people climbed inside. The windows fogged, and it was like they were gone. Saved. And then the wind picked up and began to drive the rain sideways into our ears, and our hair began to drip, and it felt good, but it also felt cold, and we couldn't help wondering what was next for us, especially after Colby's mom began praying. Dear God, please let there not be another tornado on the way. And it wasn't clear if she was actually praying for this or just stating the same fear that had begun to trickle into all of our minds. Some of the neighbors worked together to prop a piece of wallboard up against the side of what was left of their house, and they huddled under it, their clothes soggy, their feet sinking into the now saturated debris. Tears began to flow along with the rain as the reality of what had happened to us truly began to sink in. Colby's mom and sister joined them, and soon it was Colby and me, standing in the street alone, blinking at each other through raindrops clinging to our eyelashes.
There was this guy, he said, now that it was just the two of us.
He blinked off into the distance, took a breath, and turned his gaze back to me.
It was like he'd been hit by a bomb. He was in half jersey. I didn't even see where his legs had gone. I think they were buried.
Oh, my God. What about Tracy?
She didn't see it. Mom kept walking with her. But I can't stop seeing it, you know? I don't think I ever will.
I touched his shoulder lightly, then, embarrassed, pulled my hand away.
I puked, he said. And I feel like such a pussy for puking.
He shook his head.
Forget it.
The rain drove into us. I didn't know what to say to him about the half-man or about his puking. I didn't know what he wanted from me. Our relationship had always been about playing pickup games of baseball or tag or building forts and riding bikes. We didn't talk about puking or crying or being scared.
And I was. I was so, so scared.
I'm going inside, I said, like I'd said to him a million times before, like I was tired of playing hide-and-seek or wanted to watch TV or eat dinner or something else totally ordinary.
Inside where?
I gestured to what was left of my house. Basement, in case
of another tornado.
In case my mom comes home. He shook his head.
You shouldn't go back in there. It's not stable. Look how it's leaning. And the ceiling's been ripped out.
It'll be okay. It's better on the inside. Which was a total lie, but the more the thunder roared above us, the more Colby's haunted eyes transferred that image of the half-man into my soul, the more his mom prayed into the wind, the more frightened I became. Please, God, don't make me have to go through another tornado. Not again. Not alone. My heart started pounding, and I started breathing heavy, and I knew I needed to get back into the basement. Back to where I'd been safe, right away. I'll come out when the rain stops. Colby grabbed my arm, and I gently pulled away from him. I smiled. Or at least I tried to. It felt like a smile, anyway. I'll be fine, Colby. You should be with your mom and Tracy right now.
A bolt of lightning crashed, and we both jumped. You want me to go with you?
He asked, though I could tell by the way he stared anxiously at the house that he wanted the answer to be no. I could tell he felt torn between protecting me and protecting his mom and sister. I didn't want him there. Colby was a great friend, and a part of me wanted to latch onto him and hope he could keep me safe. But for some reason, the devastation behind that leaning half wall of my house felt too personal, too embarrassing. It was my family's life, all bunched up and bundled and twisted into heaps, and I didn't want him to see it, even though I knew that most of our stuff was probably lying on the street right now, getting turned into mush by the rain, and that most of his stuff was, too. It's okay, I'll be fine, I said. When my mom comes, tell her I'm inside, okay?
Okay, he said reluctantly. But if you need anything...
He trailed off, probably thinking exactly what I was thinking. Which was,
what? If I need anything, what? What can you do? You lost everything, too.
I nodded and turned back toward my house on shaking legs. There was more thunder, and my heart pounded as I climbed the steps and slipped through the front door. My brain expected to find the scene on the other side of the door, exactly like it had always been. Brown carpet, vacuum lines still scratched through it from Monday's chores, the TV on, the wall of mirrors behind the dining room table, a throwback from when the house was built in the 1970s, reflecting our mismatched garage sale table and chairs, the white linoleum with the pale blue flowers stretching into the kitchen, the light of the dishwasher blinking to indicate that the dishes inside were clean, the hum of the refrigerator and the air conditioner. Instead, it was raining. Inside my house. The wet plaster of the fallen walls smelled chalky. The only sound was the rumbling of the sky. I tried to make out something familiar, and finally I did. The television stand was missing, but the television sat there in its place, as if someone had picked up the TV and taken the stand, then set the TV back down. Of course, what use was a TV when there was no outlet to plug it into? Marin's purse was still on the chair where I'd left it. I opened it and looked inside, leaning my head over it to try to keep the relentless rain out. It was filled with 3 packs of gum and a tube of iridescent pink lipstick that Mom had handed down to her. Marin's treasures. I looped the purse over my arm and headed along the path I'd cleared earlier, trying hard not to step on anything sharp or dangerous, picking my feet up high with each step and placing them down carefully. There was so much broken glass. When I finally made it to the bottom step, I was out of the rain's reach, so I stood there and stared, squeezing water out of my hair and wiping my cheeks dry with my hands, trying to figure out what to do next. Trying to figure out how I would survive until Mom and Ronnie came home.
Chapter 6. There were a dozen bottles of water in Ronnie's mini-fridge, along with a few beers, some cheese in a jar, and a package of hot dogs. I'd had to dig through broken boards and rubble with my hands to get to the refrigerator. By the time I unearthed it, I was so thirsty I downed one of the waters while I sat on a clear spot on the floor in front of it, my fingers torn up and sore. My stomach growled heartily as I spotted the cheese, but I was afraid to eat it, unsure what we would do about food once Mom and Ronnie and Marin came home. I wanted to make sure there was enough for all of us. I wondered when we would get help on our street, and if the helpers would have food. I wondered if our real refrigerator was still upstairs somewhere, and if it still had food in it, and tried to bat away a panicked thought that the refrigerator upstairs could at any minute cave in the floor it was sitting on and bury me. I scooted back from the area where the kitchen had spilled into the basement, into the opposite corner. That section of floor had felt solid. I sat on the concrete and sipped my water, listening to the thunderstorm, watching as the rain picked up and tapered off, only to do it again, bathing the basement in shadows that got deeper and deeper as night fell full force. I didn't hear anything else outside. No voices. No sirens, no cars, just the tapping of the raindrops, the clap of the thunder. Eventually I got up and made my way over to the flipped couch. It was wet on the backside, but the cushions underneath were dry. I pulled them out and carried them to the pool table, which I'd pushed closer to my safe corner. I placed the couch cushions under the table and rounded up my backpack, Marin's purse, the flashlight, and my cell phone. I rummaged through an old dresser that Mom had stuck in the farthest corner of the basement and found a blanket we used for picnics, and on the 4th of July to watch fireworks at the park, some beach towels, and a deck of playing cards, with the date of Mom and Ronnie's Vegas honeymoon embossed on the box. I took them all, lumping the towels together like a pillow, and covering myself with the blanket. I stuffed the playing cards into Marin's purse, along with the gum and the lipstick, and then clicked on the flashlight and stretched out across the cushions on my stomach, feeling safer, as if I could wait for everyone down here until morning if need be. I didn't want to, but I'd be okay if I had to. The book I'd been reading before the tornado hit, which seemed like forever ago already, was a little damp and one of the pages had been torn, But for the most part, it was all still there, and I decided to finish it to pass the time. I wondered if Miss Soper's house had been destroyed too, and if the high school was still standing. Surely it was. It had to be. Jane might have been inside it. I imagined everyone going back to school with stories to tell about how they'd weathered the storm, about how their houses were damaged or their cars were messed up. "What about Jersey Cameron and Colby Combs?" I imagined them saying. "They aren't here. I heard they lost everything." I didn't want them doing that. I didn't want everyone talking about how Jersey Cameron, the mousy drama club girl, had nothing now. I groaned and rolled to my back, staring up at the bottom of the pool table, the book slack in my hands. With my free hand, I dug my cell phone out of my pocket and tried to call Mom again. Still nothing. "Where are you, Mom? When will you get to me?" I pulled up my messaging and thumbed a text to Danny. "Am in basement. Okay, but everything destroyed. You?" And then typed out a similar text to Jane. "Made it through tornado. You okay?" I stared at my phone screen, hoping that the messages would go through, but after a few seconds, an error message popped up instead. My stomach rumbled again, and I turned over and opened Marin's purse. A waft of cinnamon and mint puffed out in my face, along with the familiar scent of my mom's makeup and my sister's shampoo. I dug around until I found a full pack of gum, unwrapped a piece, and stuck it into my mouth to quiet my hunger. I chewed, listening to the rain continue, and turned the foil wrapper in my fingers. I thought about my sister. Marin hated storms. She was probably freaking out right now, especially if she was trapped in a dark closet with her dance classmates, smooshed together, the skin of their arms sweating up against one another. Mom would be trying to calm her, rubbing her sticky curls and talking to her, maybe singing to her, trying to think of a way out. I hope they were okay. I hope they were in the police station, or a grocery store, or someplace safe, trying to call me, trying to figure out how to navigate the car to the house, to save me. I pulled a pen out of my backpack and bent over the little square of foil. I drew a stick figure on tiptoes, arms out and legs bent, curved lines surrounding the figure to indicate motion. I gave the stick figure big eyes with long eyelashes and a smiling mouth, then added a princess crown to the top of its head just for fun. "Marin does the East Coast swing," I wrote under the picture, then held up the foil and gazed at it, a smile curving my lips. Marin would love it when she saw it. I folded the picture over itself into tinier and tinier squares, then tucked it in the zippered pocket inside the purse. By the time morning came, the rain had stopped, leaving in its wake a sharp light that gave everything a vivid edge. I unwound myself from my blanket and slid out from under the table, blinking, the events of the day before rushing in on me. It wasn't a dream, I thought with disappointment. The tornado really did happen. I pulled my phone out of my pocket and checked the time. It was 11 a.m., and I had no messages. I tried to call Mom's phone again and wasn't surprised when my attempt was greeted with an automated message saying my call couldn't go through. It was hot already. My hair stuck to my neck, and I could feel a bead of sweat slowly making its way down the small of my back. My legs were goosebumpy where the blanket had wrapped around them and trapped in body heat all night. The wreckage on the open side of the basement had become saturated and was now baking in the May sun. It was already starting to stink. I was hungry. I was thirsty. And worst of all, I had to go to the bathroom. My eyes landed on a paint bucket Ronnie used to store rags. How embarrassing. I would hold it. To keep my mind off my bladder, I went to the refrigerator and ate two cold hot dogs, which were starting to not be so cold anymore. I wondered how long they would still be good. After I finished them, I took out a bottle of water, shutting the door as quickly as possible to conserve as much cold air as I could. I leaned back against the refrigerator and listened to the noises outside.
I heard disjointed words like in there and destroyed and keep pressure on it and ambulance and overwhelmed. Somewhere in the distance, I heard the buzzing of a chainsaw. I listened for Mom's voice, for Ronnie's, Marin's. I listened for my name, for cries of hope. I didn't hear any of that. When the pain in my bladder got to be too much, I finally mustered up my courage and walked over to the bucket, feeling silly and embarrassed, hoping nobody suddenly came down to rescue me at that moment. Next to the bucket, I spotted an old pair of Ronnie's work boots. They were filthy and ugly, clumps of dead grass and blots of dried paint crusted on them. But old shoes were better than no shoes. One by one, I tipped them upside down and pounded them against the floor, in case there were bugs in them, then crammed a rag into the toe of each and slipped them on, lacing them tight around my ankles. I felt like Frankenstein, stomping across the basement floor, and I tripped over the toes a couple of times. My feet were hot, making me feel sweatier than I already was, and I wished I had an air conditioner to sit in front of, or a cold shower to stand under. But instead, I had the humid Missouri air pressing in on me, keeping my sweat tight against my skin. With the light flooding in, it was easier to see where I was going this time, and I was able to spot some of our things buried under toppled furniture and shingles. I made my way upstairs and stood in what used to be our living room, pulling out items I thought Mom would be interested in keeping. Her bathrobe, dripping and smelly and warm, streaked with mud, which I draped across an overturned table. DVDs still in their cases, which I stacked neatly on the floor. Bedsheets, which had twined their way around furniture legs and twisted into ropes. I wondered what those must have looked like as the tornado passed over. Did they reach up to the sky, great white flags of surrender? I cleaned up as much as I could, which wasn't much, and then headed outside, searching for Colby. I found him sitting on a patch of grass, eerily close to where I'd seen him standing outside my kitchen window the day before. He was holding a cloth against his arm. I headed over. "You made it through the night," he said when he saw me coming. "What happened?" I motioned to his arm as I sat down next to him. He shrugged. "Cut it on a window." I could see blood seeping through the makeshift bandage, which appeared to be a damp purple bandana. "Is it bad?" He stared off into the sky, pressing the cloth down harder. "It probably could use some stitches, but how am I going to manage that?" I reached over and picked up a corner of the bandana and gasped. A deep 5-inch gash sliced through his skin and was weeping blood. "That's really bad. You need..." But I didn't know how to finish the sentence. He needed a doctor to look at it, yes, but how are we going to get him to one?
"I'll be okay," he said. "I just need to find something that I can use to tie this to my arm."
I scanned what would have been our backyards, trying to make sense of what I was seeing, trying to pick out individual items that might be useful. It was hard to see anything but massive piles of trash.
"There," I said, and pulled myself up, clunking over some bricks to where Colby's mom's clothesline used to stand.
The pole was still there, but the line was snapped and wrapped around the base of it. I unwound it and brought it back to Colby, then sank down next to him and began wrapping it around the cloth on his arm, trying to get it tight enough to stay, but not too tight.
"How long have you been up?" I asked.
"Most of the night, really," he said, wincing every time I tugged on the line. "We remembered that Mrs. Donnelly had an old cellar. It took us a couple hours to pull everything off the doors, but I don't think anyone really slept at all. My mom's down there now. She was up most of the night, praying over people. I should have come and gotten you."
I shook my head. "I made a bed under the pool table. I was okay."
I got to the end of the twine and knotted it, tucking the loose ends under. Colby smoothed the bandage over his forearm. Already, blood was blooming on the outside of it. I could see darker purple spots growing under the rope.
"Some trucks made it through this morning," he said,
looking out at nothing. I followed his gaze. He turned to meet my eyes.
"It's bad, Jersey. They said a lot of people died."
I held his gaze for a few seconds, then looked back over the field of fallen houses.
A couple of children had appeared and were climbing on top of a car. The car's nose had been punched in, the windshield caved.
I can't believe we're all just homeless now, I said. Where are we supposed to go?
Colby picked up a splintered board and tossed it to the side, unearthing an iron. He picked up the iron and studied it idly.
We're going to Milton to stay with my aunt. I think some people are going over to Prairie Valley to stay in motels. People are going wherever they can.
He pulled himself up with a grunt and started back toward the rubble of the house. When he reached the edge, he picked up a section of siding and tossed it away.
I'm trying to find my mom's purse, so we at least have some money. Who knows if it's still here? Could be 10 miles away for all I know.
I got up and followed him, clomping over things in Ronnie's boots, bending to pick up a brick here, a board there, a hill of sopping clothes, or a ruined book somewhere else.
Careful, Colby kept murmuring. I don't know how stable everything is.
I'll be okay, I repeated over and over again, sweat rolling down my lower back and dripping off my forehead. We searched until we were both filthy and thirsty. One of the trucks that came through had deposited a couple of cases of bottled water on the street, and we took a break to get a drink.
I don't think we're going to find it, Colby said at last.
We might, I said. Marin's purse was still by the door. He took a long sip of water and didn't respond. I watched Mr. Fay toss little bits and pieces of things into a hip-high pile.
Where do you think they are?
I said at last, giving voice to the thought that had been running a loop in my head ever since Colby had told me that trucks had made it through. Colby looked down at his feet. He knew who I was talking about without me even saying it.
I don't know. Where were they when it hit?
Mom and Marin were at dance. I don't know where Ronnie was, but... I trailed off, unable to say what had been weighing on my mind. If they could have gotten through, they would have. Mom would have come to get me. She'd have been scared out of her mind for me. If they weren't here, it was because something was keeping them from coming.
We can go there, Colby said. It's not that far.
My hand shook, the water inside the bottle rippling with the motion. It's a couple miles at least, he motioned toward our houses.
It's not like there's anything good on TV right now,
he said, and though he was joking, neither one of us laughed. Nothing about any of this was funny.
Let me tell Tracy so my mom won't worry when she wakes up, he said.
And before I could say anything in protest, he loped off toward Mrs. Donnelly's cellar. Part of me was definitely ready to do this, to go out and find my mom and Marin and Ronnie. If they couldn't get to me, I'd get to them. But part of me was scared. What if I didn't find them? What if they weren't there to be found? Chapter 7. More and more vehicles were creeping down Church Street by the time we got to it, some of them stopping to pick up people who were still walking toward town, still hoping to find help. Some passengers offered bottles of water and first aid kits. Others rolled by with cameras, taking photos and gabbing about the devastation as if it were there for their entertainment. By comparison, all the people who were walking looked filthy and grim. Some wore stony, distant expressions, as if they had no idea where they were or where they were going. Some were carrying children, some were covered in dried blood. Some were telling stories, and all of the stories were similar. The house fell apart. The wind tugged at us. We got hit with something. Our houses are gone. Our cars are gone. Our streets are gone. Our lives, as we knew them, are gone.
About a half mile that direction will get you out of the storm's path, one woman told Colby, pointing to the east. It ran north and south, so if you go east, before long you'll come to regular pavement.
So we walked east on Kentucky, taking in the devastation there as we headed toward normalcy.
You smell that? Colby said, wrinkling his nose. Stinks.
I thought about the hamburger I'd crumbled up in the skillet right before the storm hit. Who knew where it had been flung, but wherever it was rotting in the sun now, along with dinners and the refrigerator guts of hundreds of other houses. "Smells like the washing machine when I forget to take the wet clothes out," I said.
"It's only going to get worse, you know," he said. "That smell, all that wet stuff and the heat."
"Food rotting," I added.
"And people," Colby said.
And he said it so matter-of-factly I stopped walking and stared at him.
"What?"
he asked, turning to face me and shrugging.
"There are dead people under some of this stuff, and dead animals, too. It's reality."
I started walking again.
"Yeah, but you don't have to say it like that, like it's no big deal. I don't like it either," he mumbled, following me.
We came up over a hill and could see where the destruction stopped, not too many yards ahead of us. It was strange seeing how the houses went from totally razed to beat up and broken to lightly damaged to completely fine. Literally, where one house was gone, the neighbor three houses down would only need to replace some shingles. It was at the end of the street where most of the people were congregating. Chainsaws buzzed and whole crowds sifted through rubble, people calling out to one another, offering help and drinks, the effort much more concerted than on our street. Someone had set up a few tents and folding tables covered with food and drinks and tools and supplies. Two of the tents shaded an assortment of lawn chairs, and some women sat there with babies. Little kids squatted on the ground and munched on grapes, watching as Colby and I scuffed by.
"You all right?"
a woman hollered to us from one of the chairs.
"You need help?"
"We're fine," I yelled back, smiling as if we were simply out on a midday stroll.
"You need something to eat?"
she called.
"There's plenty. None of us has power, so we've got to eat it while it's still good."
My stomach growled, and Colby and I looked at each other. We diverted to the tent, where I immediately grabbed a banana, and Colby palmed a sandwich, taking a huge bite out of it and closing his eyes while he chewed.
"You're hurt," the woman said, softer now as she approached us. "We've got bandages. Is it bad?"
"It's okay," Colby said,
but I overrode him. "It's pretty bad. How big are your bandages?" The woman rifled through the first aid kits, then disappeared into her house. Colby and I snacked while we waited, shoving crackers and cheese cubes into our mouths greedily. She came back out with a roll of gauze and some tape.
"It's kind of old, but it's going to be better than that," she said, handing me the gauze.
We made our way over to the chairs, and Colby peeled off the bandana and clothesline from his arm. I winced when I looked at the cut, the skin around the edges swollen and angry red.
"You're going to want to keep that clean," the woman said, making a pained face. "It looks pretty bad. What did you cut it on?"
"Glass," Colby answered.
"Good. At least it wasn't rusted metal. You're probably going to need a tetanus shot anyway. Although, I don't know where you'd go to get one right now," she said. "I suppose the Elizabeth Clinic was spared yesterday, but it's probably packed. Nobody has power."
"I'm sure it'll be fine," Colby said as I wrapped the gauze around his arm and secured it with a strip of tape. "How far did the tornado go, do you know?" he asked.
"My husband drove around this morning," the woman said. "About 7 miles or so. Hit some of the schools, the library, the hospital, the police station, fire station. Hit everything. You two need a ride somewhere? I'm sure Jerry will take you."
"We're going to Janice's dance studio," I said. "That's where my mom was. She hasn't come home yet, and I'm trying to find her."
The woman's face paled.
"On 6th?
I nodded.
"Oh, honey, he won't be able to get you in there. 6th got hit bad."
"Oh, okay," I said, trying to ignore the lump that had suddenly formed in my throat.
"We'll walk."
The woman offered a smile that didn't quite hold up the corners of her mouth.
"I hear they're setting up tents at some of the churches," she said.
She looked at Colby and lowered her voice, as if I weren't standing right there.
"They'll be starting to compile lists. There's a Lutheran church right around the corner on Muncie Avenue."
Colby nodded and grabbed my elbow, pulling me back into the street.
"What kind of lists?" I asked,
when we got a little way down the road. He took a long time to answer.
Of missing people, he finally said. And, you know,
my heart went cold.
I know what?
He stopped, still holding my elbow, his knuckles grazing my side. Ordinarily, I would be mortified at a boy touching my side, afraid that he'd feel the wobbly skin there. But I was too intent on hearing him say it aloud, that they would be compiling lists of the missing and the dead, to worry about something so stupid as whether or not I was stick skinny.
Come on, Jersey, it doesn't matter, he said. We'll go to Janice's and see what's up before we worry about what kind of lists they've got at the churches. Just because she said it doesn't make it true.
When we turned onto 6th Street, we navigated in the direction we'd come from, making our way back into the heart of the destruction. Under normal circumstances, I knew this part of town like the back of my hand, but the farther west we went, the harder it was to recognize anything. The woman had been right. 6th Street had been hit bad, most of the buildings ripped right off their foundations. No leaning walls here. There were no signs, no street markers, no landmarks at all. Other than a handful of people determinedly digging through debris where Fenderman's Grocery used to be, there weren't even any people.
I think it was here, I said, stopping and facing a mostly bare rectangle of concrete.
Around the concrete was mud. Even the grass had been stripped. It was almost as if the tornado had tried to dig down into the ground with its twisting fingers and scoop Janice's off the earth. Colby walked over to the concrete and bent to pick up something. It was a small ballet shoe. Too small to have been Marin's, but still the sight of it brought tears to my eyes.
They aren't here, I said.
Colby dropped the shoe. I tried to remember where the cloak closet was. It had been a while since I'd come to the studio with Mom and Marin, and I was turned around by everything being gone. I stumbled across the concrete to the far corner. Where walls had once been anchored into the floor, now just a few splintered boards stuck up from the ground. There were a couple of empty gym bags caught on a ripped-off piece of stud, but otherwise there was nothing.
They aren't here, I repeated.
I know, Colby said. Sorry. I sank to the ground on my knees. When I'd called Mom, had she been right here? Had this been where she'd been shouting to get down, where she'd been ordering me to the basement, where she'd been unable to hear me? I pressed my palms onto the gritty floor. A handprint stamped itself into the drying grime.
I don't know what to do, I said.
But Colby didn't answer, which made me unsure whether I'd said it out loud.
Colby? What do I do?
Colby used his foot to scrape some shattered glass out of the way, then came over to where I knelt on the ground.
I don't know, he said.
I turned my eyes up to him.
What if they're dead?
I asked.
What if they all died?
The question felt like a punch to my stomach. Colby knelt next to me. He didn't try to tell me they weren't dead. I guess that was because he knew this looked as bad as I thought it did. They might be dead, or they might be injured, or in comas, or God knew what else. Telling me they were anything other than that would be a lie, and we both knew it. If they were alive and fine, they would have come home. Mom would have come for me. The food I'd wolfed down in the tents roiled in my stomach as Colby's silence sank in. I scrambled clumsily up to my feet and thunked as far away from him as I could, before bending at the waist and vomiting on a bare spot of dirt. I heard shuffling sounds as he stood up.
I'm sorry, I said between retches.
I'm sorry.
It's okay, he said.
And when I finished and came back to him, he clumsily patted my back between my shoulder blades.
Let's go to the church, he said. Maybe they'll know something.
We scuffed away from Janice's and toward the Lutheran church. The woman we'd talked to was right. They had set up a tent full of supplies. Colby and I grabbed water bottles from a bucket of ice as soon as we reached the tent. I opened mine and began sipping it while Colby downed his. The tent was stuffed with people who looked just as homeless and dazed as we were.
Can I help you?
A woman in sandals, a tan vest, and a safari hat said, hurrying to greet us. "Do you have lists?" I blurted out, getting to the worst before I tried to talk myself out of wanting to know.
"What kind of lists are you looking for, honey?"
she said, putting her hand on my shoulder and pulling me toward a table where she eased me into a folding chair. "I can't find my mom or my sister," I said. "They were at Janice's dance studio?" The last came out as a question, as if part of me was hoping that the woman would tell me I was wrong, that my mom and sister had never been at the studio, that they'd ridden out the storm safe and sound in someone's basement instead. The woman's face fell a little, but she recovered very quickly. She leaned to the side and picked up a clipboard.
"You want to add them to the list of those who are missing?"
she asked. "Is there another list?" I asked. "Of people who didn't make it through?" She shook her head.
"It's too early, and I'm afraid we haven't been getting many updates about that," she said. "The power's out all over Elizabeth, which is making communication a challenge, but we're compiling a list of the missing, so families who aren't in contact with one another can at least see that someone else in the family is looking for them."
"Is her name on there?" Colby asked, pointing to the list. "Jersey Cameron?"
He looked at me eagerly.
"Maybe they're looking for you, too."
The woman scanned the list, running her finger down the names, her lips moving. At last she looked up and gave a rueful head shake.
"No, honey, I'm sorry it's not. But we'll add your mom and sister to this list."
"And my stepdad," I interrupted miserably. I felt my chin shake. "Everyone."
"Okay, we'll put their names down on the list, and that way when they get their bearings and come looking for you, they'll know you're fine," she said.
I gave her my information, along with Mom's, Ronnie's, and Marin's, but my voice got thick and tears welled in my eyes as I talked. The woman put down her pen and stared at me sympathetically.
"Honey, do you have somewhere to go? Someone you can try to get a hold of? We've got some cots we're setting up in the sanctuary in the basement, and we can work with you to get in touch with any family you might have outside of Elizabeth. Or Child Protective Services."
Fear wrecked my body. I couldn't go sleep on a cot in a church basement and wait for a social worker to show up and send me off to foster care. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I wasn't going to do that. I eyed Colby, who had gone over to another table where a woman was pouring peroxide over his cut. "I'm staying with his family," I said, "until we find mine." I tried to smile, though it felt counterfeit on my face. Colby was going to be leaving town to stay with his aunt, he'd said. He wasn't going to take care of me. His mom wasn't going to take care of me. They hadn't offered, and even if they had, I wouldn't go. What if Mom came back after I left?
"Okay," the woman said. "But our doors are always open. We've had donations of clothes coming in all morning. You might go through those boxes over there and pick out a few things. Also, feel free to take any food and supplies you may need. We expect we'll be getting lots more donations by tomorrow. Plenty of folks have already been coming in with truckloads of stuff."
"Thank you," I said, but I didn't take anything. My stomach was still sour with nerves and exhaustion, and the last thing I cared about was my clothes. I still had water in the mini-fridge in the basement. I wanted to get out of there before I ended up having to stay. The woman who was tending to Colby's arm slathered some cream on it and rewrapped it, telling him about the cots and the clothes and the food as well.
"You going to stay?"
he asked when we were alone again.
"No, I'm going back. I don't want them to freak out if they somehow make it home and I'm gone."
My words felt hollow to me, like something I didn't really believe in. But Colby must have known how much I needed to say them. He didn't question me. Just started walking back the way we had come. We got a ride back to our street from Jerry, the husband of the woman at the tent on Kentucky. He filled us in on details, what the radio newscasters were saying about the tornado. At least 100 people dead, so many more injured. But Colby only answered him in grunts and thoughtful humming noises. He didn't add anything of his own, and I didn't respond either. I watched out the window as the destruction rolled into view and thought, home, this is my home, and wondered if 3 of those 100 dead belonged to me, and how soon I would find out for sure.
Chapter 8. It rained again that night. I sat outside on what used to be my front porch and watched the rain fall, let it soak into the skin of my forearms and drip off my earlobes. I took off Ronnie's boots and wriggled my toes in it, the closest I could get to feeling somewhat washed. Colby's mom tried and tried to get me to join them in Mrs. Donnelly's cellar. "Honey, your mama will find you there," she promised. "You can leave her a note." I stared at the raindrops, which landed in heavy splats on the toes of Ronnie's boots, washing away the dirt and dust that had gathered there during our walk.
"Sweetheart, you need to take care of yourself. The last thing you want is to get sick now. Come into the cellar and dry off. Get yourself something to eat. We've got canned pickles and peaches down there. Mr. Fay brought over some crackers as well."
I blinked slowly and shook my head.
"Honey, nobody's gonna be staying here much longer. You're gonna have to go someplace, too. It's unsafe. It's unhealthy."
A drop of water slid down my nose. Finally, Colby's mom said a quick prayer that I was too numb to listen to and picked her way back to Mrs. Donnelly's cellar, her big hips shaking with every step. I watched the rain. I watched people disappear into the cellar and into their relatives' cars and into the night. A few of the neighbors had already fled to nearby motels. Colby would be leaving for Milton first thing in the morning. Soon I would be the only one still here. If Mom didn't show up, I would eventually lose my options. Someone would find me, would force me to go to the cots in the church, would force me to go to Child Protective Services, to a foster home. I wasn't about to voluntarily give up my freedom before then. In so many ways, control over where I slept and ate was all I had left, and maybe not for much longer. I was going to hang on to it as long as I could. After a while, goosebumps rose up on my arms, and when thunder boomed off in the distance, I began to shiver, even though I didn't feel cold. I didn't want to go inside. I didn't want to be afraid. I wanted to be like I always had been. The kind of girl who didn't pay attention to the weather. The kind of girl who sometimes went outside and danced around in the rain, who stuck her bare feet under the downspout to wash grass clippings off. The kind of girl whose mom stood on the front porch, soda in hand, smiling and watching as her daughter let the crying sky drench her, until her shirt and shorts were stuck to her like a second skin. Instead, I was shaking, my heart pounding, my eyes drifting worriedly to the sky, trying to remember what it had looked like before the tornado touched down, and if it had been similar to what it looked like now, wishing I'd paid more attention. By the second crash of thunder, I couldn't take it anymore. I ducked back into the house, not even bothering to stop and sift through our belongings this time, heading for the basement and the safety of the pool table, carrying Ronnie's boots in my hands. Once downstairs, I dropped the boots and climbed under the pool table and wrapped myself in one of the towels I'd found in the bureau, pulling my knees to my chest, my teeth chattering. I sat next to the couch cushion, bent forward at the shoulders so my head would clear the bottom of the table, wondering what I would do next. My body was tired from all the walking, but my mind was racing. What little food I had would spoil soon, and the water bottles would only last so long. I was filthy. The living room floor could cave in on me at any time. Rain was beginning to pool on the basement floor, inching toward me. Soon I would have no choice but to leave. I wished more than anything for a TV or a radio, anything to break the silence, anything to cover the noise of the relentless rain pattering and the weird sound it made on our house now that our house was no longer standing. I longed for voices or music or laughter or chanting, anything to break up the monotony, anything to remind me that I was still here, still alive. What I wouldn't have given to listen to Marin's chatter, to have her stand in front of my face begging me to dance with her. Life with Marin was never quiet. Life without her seemed so still it was maddening. I snaked my hand out from under the towel and unzipped her purse. I pulled out Mom's lipstick and opened it. I closed my eyes and smelled it, letting the scent of Mom wash over me, cradle me. I missed her so much. "Please, Mom," I said aloud, "be out there somewhere.
Be alive. Come find me. I closed the lipstick and dropped it back into the purse, then grabbed a stick of gum and popped it into my mouth. Thunder rolled, and I jumped, thinking about Marin and how much she hated thunderstorms. When one came through Elizabeth, Marin would wander the house on her tiptoes, holding her hands over her ears, her eyes big and wet and worried. She constantly asked, "Is it over? Huh? Huh, Jersey? Is it fine?" Once, a few weeks before, when Mom was gone on an errand, I couldn't take it anymore. Marin's eyes had gone from wet to spilling over, and her voice had gotten smaller and smaller. "Is it fine, Jersey? Is the noise fine?" She was nearing full meltdown mode, and I knew I had to do something to distract her. I had learned during fifth grade summer camp that I was apparently some sort of card genius. I'd taken a gaming elective and had paired up with a counselor named John, with no H. He was constantly telling people, to the point where everyone called him No H John, all one word, like that was his name, who spent the entire 4 weeks teaching me new card games and then trying in vain to beat me at them. He couldn't do it. Nobody could. I guess everybody is naturally gifted at something. If my gift couldn't be music or sports or theater or chemistry or something worthwhile, I supposed being gifted at cards wasn't all that bad a sentence. It had been a long time since I'd played, but I still remembered all the games, and that afternoon I decided Marin was finally old enough to play with. "Is the noise fine, Jersey? Is it over?" "Come here, Mare," I said, pulling a worn deck of cards that No H. John had given me as a goodbye present when summer camp was over out of my top dresser drawer. "I'll teach you how to play 66. She'd followed me into my room, warily taking her hands down from her ears, and had climbed up onto my bed. I sat cross-legged across from her and shuffled the cards. "Okay, so you know how the princes and princesses always get married in those movies you like?" Marin nodded, already sucked in. "That's pretty much what this game is about. You want the kings and queens to get married." The storm had moved through, Marin and I playing 66 and then go fish. When we started playing solitaire, I told her that technically solitaire was a game for one person, not two. She'd argued that we were playing our own kind of solitaire, the kind that two people play. So I'd dubbed the game couples solitaire and had gone with it. The wind beating the rain against our house went unnoticed by my sister. The hail that dropped for a few seconds was totally ignored. Even the thunder didn't register with anything more than a concerned upward glance as she held a fan of cards in her pudgy hand. That was all it ever took with Marin. Just some time together. Just some attention. I could make her day by saying hello to her. I could have made her so happy if I'd just once gotten off the couch and danced with her. I flicked on the flashlight and smoothed out the foil gum wrapper. I drew a picture of a stick figure with its hands over its ears, a window behind the figure streaked with dashes of rain. "Marin hates thunderstorms," I wrote. I drew a vertical line down the center of the foil and drew a hand holding some playing cards. I colored in the tiny fingernails. Marin always had polished fingernails. "Marin likes thunderstorms sometimes," I wrote underneath. I studied my artwork appreciatively, and then folded the foil into a tiny square and stuck it in the zippered pocket along with the other I'd drawn. The thunder crashed again, a flash of lightning blooming brightness into the basement, and I jumped. I grabbed the deck of cards I'd found alongside the towels in the dresser drawer. I opened the box and pulled out the cards, idly wondering if my deck from No H. John was buried under rubble upstairs, or if it was blown away, if the dresser was gone entirely, or if it sat there, pristine and untouched amid the debris, the way Marin's purse had been. I counted the cards, pulling out the jokers, and when I was satisfied that I had a full deck, I shuffled them and laid them out in a line. "For you, Marin," I thought, beginning my first game of solitaire. "And for couples solitaire." I played hand after hand, winning some, losing others, cheating a couple times so I wouldn't have to re-deal. I played until my eyes were tired and my fingers were lazy and the flashlight beam began to dull, making me squint to see the numbers. I slapped the cards on the floor, all the while wondering what the next day would hold for me. Colby would be gone. My cell phone would probably still be useless, if it even had a battery left. I would be hungry and thirsty and dirty. I would spend some time digging through broken stuff that used to be our belongings, our treasures. I would worry and wonder and wait for Mom. Eventually the storm picked up, the rain hammering against the ground and the wind raking it farther and farther into the basement. I tired of my game and gathered the cards together, stuffing them into the box, then putting the box back in Marin's purse. As the lightning flashes came closer and closer together, I wound myself up in my blanket and stretched out over the couch cushions, falling asleep almost immediately, trying to push my worries about the next day out of my head, hoping for a miracle. Chapter 9. I awoke to a voice. "Dear Jesus," it said, and I opened my eyes to the underside of the pool table, unsure where I was. I had been dreaming about school. I'd been at the lunch table with Danny and Jane, but none of us could find any food, and I was so thirsty, and for a few seconds I had forgotten about the tornado. But then the voice, anguished, got closer. "Jersey?" I was fully awake then. At first I thought it was Colby coming down to say goodbye, but the voice was older, gruffer. "Ronnie?" I croaked, sitting up and letting the blanket fall off me. It was done raining, but was still gray outside, and I wasn't sure if that was because it was cloudy or because it was early. "Jesus," Ronnie repeated, his breath expelling the word in a gush. "Oh, God." I slid out from under the pool table and rushed to him, wrapping my arms around his waist, which I'd never done before. Marin was constantly climbing all over her dad, but I'd always sensed a barrier there. He wasn't my father, so hugging him felt weird and awkward, too close. Now part of me needed to hold on to him, if for no other reason than to prove to myself that he really was standing there. It wasn't my imagination. Ronnie was real, and he was standing in the basement. The tornado hadn't gotten him. I buried my face in his chest and sobbed with relief. Ronnie rested his hands tentatively on the backs of my shoulders, and at first he made shushing noises like he used to do when Marin was a cranky infant, but after a while I was pretty sure he was crying too. Finally I pulled away, rubbing my blurry eyes. Ronnie turned, his hands on his hips, and surveyed the basement, taking deep, sniffling breaths through his nose.
"Gone," he said. "Everything."
Where were you? I had so many things I wanted to ask and say, and I wasn't sure where to begin. Have you heard from Mom? Is your phone working? Where are they? What are we going to do? He scuffed over toward his workbench, or where his workbench used to be, as it was now covered with most of the kitchen, and kicked something metal. His curses echoed over the clanging, then he kicked something else. I stepped forward tentatively. What had once been puddles of rainwater on the floor was now one big pool, and Ronnie was standing right in the middle of it.
"God damn, everything is gone,"
he shouted, and crashed through a pile of broken dishes with the heel of his boot.
"All of it."
"Ronnie," I said, "have you heard from Mom? Is she okay?" He turned, and it was only then that I noticed how horrible he looked, probably at least as bad as I did. Grungy, sweaty stubble coating his chin, his hair greasy. His face was red and his nose was running right down over his top lip. His eyes were bloodshot like he hadn't had any sleep in